Hello, and welcome to the Sheldrake Vernon Dialogues, formerly known as Science Set Free. I'm here, Mark Vernon, with Rupert Sheldrake. Hi, Rupert.
Hello, Mark.
Our conversations are when we come together and talk through some things that have been on our minds, not because we have all the answers, but because we're interested and hope that our conversations might prompt conversations elsewhere too. Do please feel free to pass the conversation around, to share it online, subscribe on YouTube, and hope that you enjoy our discussion today, which I thought could be about magic. I don't know whether this feels timely to you, but I feel that magic maybe is one of the themes of 2018. It feels like various people are picking it up in different ways.
Yes.
I've just been reading Dean Radin's new book, where he really tries to reframe the whole of Psy research in terms of magic, which I thought was very interesting and something which you all know about, obviously.
Yeah, I'm reading it too, so I'm very happy to discuss it.
Yeah, yes. And then also this just sort of general sense of ecology, which feels gets quite close often to animism, interest in intentionality, attraction, all that side of things as well feels it's bordering in this area. So
yes.
Try and tease some of these ideas out.
Mm.
I mean, it's a good place to start to think about research into parapsychology, into psi, which you've obviously been involved with, over many decades. Dean Radin, as you might expect, very much starts from the point that, in terms of pure science, various phenomena now are well established. There are sceptics that constantly pop up to try and knock it down, but anyone who seems to look at this research seriously, with a cool mind, concludes that the evidence in the lab is convincing. You know, that there's a very powerful quote that he uses actually in the book from Jessica Utz, who was the president of the American Statistical Association. So, you know, very cool-headed person. And she, a couple of years back when she was president, gave a speech to the meeting, their major meeting, saying, you know, that if you look at this coolly, you see that the effect sizes are significant. There's no two ways about it. So what are we going to do about that? Is kind of her starting point.
I thought, yes, I read that bit too. And I thought one of the things she said was very interesting, that she'd come across many critics and asked them if they knew the evidence and had hardly ever met any of them who knew any of the evidence at all. So it's not informed scepticism, it's dogmatic scepticism that we're mainly dealing with.
And it's really important for her because she got into the field because she thought it would be a really good test case to test statistics.
Yes.
And see, you know, what can creep in unawares, and has concluded that nothing is creeping in unawares in the parapsychology domain.
Mm.
So she felt like an important witness to me. So starting from there, Dean Radin's idea is that if you accept that starting point, then perhaps consciousness, vitality, a sort of spiritedness actually underpins the whole of reality. And so what we might be engaging with in various experiences, you know, whether it be presentiment experiences, telepathy, clairvoyancy, these various experiences that people have, are we also engaging with a sort of side of nature that has a life of its own, a will of its own? And he wants to investigate it, I think, in that way too. And now, is that how you have approached your various experiments and engagement as well? Or how does that sort of reframing strike you?
Well, I don't think it's necessary to go quite as far as saying there's a spirit in all nature to deal with parapsychology. I think parapsychology, is mainly telepathy, which is what I've worked on, is about the relations between bonded members of social groups. Human telepathy occurs most commonly between strongly bonded people like mothers and babies, best friends, lovers, spouses, brothers and sisters, twins, and occurs most commonly in things to do with like telephone calls, where there's a need that the other picks up. And telepathy between humans and animals, again, is to do with bonded pairs or bonded groups, like dogs that know when their owners are coming home. So I think that these telepathic phenomena, at least, are about interconnections between members of animal or human social groups. That doesn't necessarily bring in the whole of nature into a different worldview. It certainly expands our view of minds. And now clairvoyance seeing things in different places, remote viewing, as it's usually called. That's more of a stretch. It suggests that minds can operate non-locally in some sense, but it's still about minds seeing things at a distance. And the other main form of ESP, extrasensory perception, is premonition or presentiment, feeling the future, or seeing a glimpse of the future in a dream, for example, a precognitive dream. That is about a relationship between our minds and our own minds in the future, as far as I can tell from the literature and the research. So none of this requires us to go beyond the realm of human and animal minds into a whole new philosophy of nature. I mean, I think we need a new philosophy of nature for other reasons, but I don't think that psychical research itself is enough to propel us there.
I wonder about the area of intention, because the area of intention feels like it's a sort of spectrum. And at one end would be the intention that perhaps is associated with prayer, you know, so essentially sending out good intentions. And again, there's research which is harder to control in this domain, but nonetheless there is research which suggests that intention can have an impact upon people's well-being and their flourishing and so on. But then there's another kind of intention which is, I think, sometimes called the law of attraction, which is that what you intend will come towards you, as if this is a sort of fundamental feature of the cosmos. I think it's, you know, quite a common feature in various New Age movements. Perhaps the biggest manifestation of this was the book The Secret, that was a huge bestseller. And to my mind, that made a mistake, because it seemed to suggest that the cosmos was in your service and you could essentially will what you wanted, and you didn't have to do any of the work about asking what you might be in service of, which feels to me a fundamental difference. You know, it's about you aligning yourself with a deeper force that pulses through all things, which is a very ancient idea, rather than getting that force to do its, you know, do stuff for you. But that feels getting more into the area of magic somehow.
Yes, I mean, the secret, the intention thing is about... it's related to positive thinking. That's the other form in which it's part of popular culture. You form an intention of something and affirm that intention repeatedly, and it's likely to come true. Now, that's like a secular form of prayer, but just as you said, it's not about doing God's will or being part of the flow of nature. It's about getting what you want. And I think this is one of the reasons why magic has had a bad press over the centuries. It's not new, the bad press for magic. I mean, in the Bible there are lots of denunciations of magicians. The biblical denunciations are not saying these people are frauds, it doesn't work, but they're saying that they're doing it for the wrong reasons. So most of the forms of magic of the positive thinking kind or of the secret kind are about getting what you want, success in love and business, through positive thinking or through affirmations. So that kind of magic is about just getting what you want. And some of the magic that's popularly portrayed in magical cults and also in voodoo seems to be about getting what you want. You want someone to fall in love with you, so you create a magic spell that makes them fall in love with you. And then, of course, black magic, you want to do someone harm, so you do some spell that's going to bring disaster upon them. That's where we get into an area where it all becomes rather murky, and where people have had a prejudice against it. Not the modern ideological prejudice of skeptics that it's rubbish, it doesn't work, but that it's not a good thing if it's done for purely selfish reasons.
Yeah, I mean, that buys into the idea that our engagement with the cosmos, with nature, with gods, changes over time. My friend Jules Evans has done a lot of work on this in relation to psychedelics and how in indigenous cultures, plants like ayahuasca or magic mushrooms were traditionally taken in order to influence the local spirits. and often in practice that meant, you know, cursing a neighbour or, you know, willing well for someone who was kin or family. It seems to me that that can easily get confused with a more modern consciousness, where in a way you might say our concerns aren't those very basic things about health and sustenance and security, because we find those in other ways. And it seems to me that our engagement with that kind of magic therefore is calling forth something much more ethical from us, actually, that our consciousness now is much more about how we can realign ourselves to nature and the cosmos, rather than defend ourselves from these overwhelming forces, which we don't really need to do anymore. So I've been quite persuaded there's quite a substantial shift, and that if you get involved in trying to use these techniques solely to serve your own ends, it overinflates you. It turns you into sort of small god. You know, I don't think it's any coincidence that the power of positive thinking, as you mentioned, has been quite closely associated with people like Donald Trump and various other you know, major figures now. This is something which another friend of mine, Gary Lachman, has been writing about, the influence of these magical and occult ideas in politics, in modern politics. It seems to me that we live in an age which calls us to be more ethically minded, more responsible, you might say. Our engagement with things needs to be very, very different. We need to be solving different problems, not just getting more and more and more.
Well, yes, but on the other hand, you know, the one of the perennial phenomena, especially of American publishing, is self-help books, which are all about competitive advantage, you know, how to get the edge over everyone else to succeed in business or in love, and, you know, the 12 laws of success, the this and that. There's all these books about how to get ahead. How to Win Friends and Influence People is one of the classics, The Power of Positive Thinking, Norman Vincent Peale. I mean, the secret, there's one after another of these, and very few of them are primarily concerned with the good of the planet. They're largely concerned with a highly individualistic culture and getting what you want.
So can there be a magic which counters that in some way, which isn't just about amplifying, you might say, the magic of technology that already delivers us many of these things to the detriment of the planet and the environment?
Well, surely magic that is in aligned with the greater good is called prayer. It seems to me the dividing line between prayer and magic is rather a blurred one. And prayer is, as Dean Radin mentions in his book, I mean, is akin to magic in the sense you're praying for something to happen that hasn't yet happened. You're forming an intention. But in prayer, you're aligning your prayer with a greater good, the good of the planet, the good of other people, the will of God. Whereas in positive thinking or magic, you're not necessarily doing that.
Yeah, and this would be the evolution of consciousness idea, that the gift for us now is not just survival, but is maybe a more transcendent experience of life. And that's sort of what we lack. So when magic and intention and prayer just gets turned on the accumulation of more stuff or more power or better sex lives, whatever it might be, it seems to me that that is sort of missing what could be the real revelation, the real transformation of our times, and is also the thing which we so much lack, because we don't have this sense of engaging with the inner life of nature, the inner life of the cosmos so much anymore. Mm. It's very much about the amplification of our the sort of egoic life of ourselves otherwise.
Yes.
This debate went on in the ancient world too, to some degree, which is interesting because in Plato and in the Platonic tradition it's there, which I think is part of the turning point of our own consciousness. So it came up back then. And it was around the idea of theurgy, you know, which is another word, theurgy, the work of the gods. And in later Platonists, like Iamblichus, you have a big discussion about what the purpose of this all is. And broadly speaking, I think someone like Iamblichus says, look, theurgy is about resonating appropriately, in a way for your own personal development, resonating with the appropriate level of nature in the cosmos. They had a kind of hierarchy of being notion, and the material, tangible, physical world is at one end of the spectrum, and then the divine, immaterial, spiritual, transcendent, even ineffable a world as another, and that by using theurgy to resonate with different parts of this hierarchy, you propel your own development. And then this is picked up in Renaissance magic as well. I think this is the conclusion that Ficino came to, that there might be certain times of life where you'd use some quite material magic. You know, so he would advise, if you're feeling melancholic, to surround yourself with golden things, because they will channel an energy which he ultimately associated with the sun, to lift, as it were, your immediate spirits. But that this was just a sort of very basic kind of magic, and that developing a sympathy with that which was more, which was less tangible, for example, noetic ideas, feeling your mind resonating or fitting into that more abstract notion of the good and the beautiful, could lift you to another level of the hierarchy of being. So it was sort of magic where you were nurturing a resonance within yourself, rather than calling, you know, the world to your own purposes. That kind of theurgy I find really quite appealing and attractive.
But how does theurgy differ from prayer?
Well, I guess that, in a way, I suppose that prayer is a sort of popularisation of theurgy, I guess. Certainly the kind of prayer which you meet in church feels to me to be a sort of a good starting point for this. You know, so praying for others, praying for yourself, opening yourself to the resonance of the spirit. I feel it's a bit of a, people never quite get off the starting block though in church with prayer. It feels, you know, you ask for things and you hope that things might change if you're suffering, but how much prayer can take you into something more than just kind of keeping your fingers crossed and hoping God responds, it can feel a bit like that to me sometimes.
No, but if even in private prayers, I mean, theurgy involves calling on gods by definition, or divine beings, then if you're praying in private prayer, you're praying to God, or you're praying to angels, or you're praying to saints, I suppose. I mean, those are, what else would you be praying to?
Yeah, I mean, the idea would be that those, so saints and angels, and then God in God's self, the spirit, these would be different sort of levels, as it were. There's an appropriateness about the God you call on, the spirit that you call on, depending upon, you know, who you are, your need at that time. And I guess it's in a sort of traditional mythology where you might pray to St. Anthony if you've lost something.
Yes.
You know, a relatively trivial issue, but that Anthony, as it were, has been assigned to that level of things.
Yes.
But to pray to God the Father that you might get a parking place outside the supermarket, which is kind of what you feel many Christians do now, it seems a bit of a mockery of the whole thing.
Well, if people do that, I mean, a lot of people get parking places through positive thinking, at least they tell me that. Most people who talk about positive thinking use the parking place example. I mean, Christians can pray to God the Father, to God the Son, or to God the Holy Spirit. There's three ways of praying to God, or to God the Holy Trinity, all at once. And praying for peace in the world, for example, is a fairly common theme of prayer. This seems a fairly big issue and a fairly big way of praying, too. Would you call that theurgy?
I don't know quite what it is, actually. I mean, it seems like, in general, a good thing to do. But I suppose I do feel a bit of lack of discernment, you know, when these prayers are said, repeated, you know, is it a bit unthinking? It's just kind of what we've always done. You know, maybe there's a different kind of prayer for peace that needs to be discerned. You know, when contemplatives pray for peace, it feels like they're trying to cultivate a space of peace in their contemplative life, with a sense that if nothing else, it keeps that alive, and maybe there's a sense that that peace, that spirit of peace, might therefore spread out from that.
Mm.
You know, that feels very different to me from, you know, rather, if I say formulaic, that's a bit strong. I don't mean it just formulaically, but nonetheless, just sort of repeating the old prayers for peace. I suppose I do feel that some more thought needs to be done about what this theurgy, what this prayer is really trying to cultivate. Maybe we're called to think about it more ourselves. You know, that's, again, that's where we're at, our state of consciousness now. Not just, as it were, rather blindly repeating them.
Yes. Well, I don't know who's doing work on new forms of prayer. I was forced to think about it when I, in the late 1970s, I helped organise a praying for peace movement. There were a lot of people, the Cold War was still going on. Cruise missiles were being installed all over Europe. There was a sense of increasing nuclear danger. And a number of us here in Britain organised praying for peace in particular places. PPPP, four P's. For peace, you see. We thought that was quite a good name for it. But what we did was each person adopted a nuclear base in Britain and one in Czechoslovakia, and different countries were paired. So you'd get one American nuclear base in Britain and one Russian nuclear base in Czechoslovakia, and you'd, if those were what were assigned to you, those were what you'd pray for. So the idea was, instead of the overwhelming thing, peace, such a huge thing, you can't focus on it, have it in particular places. And then we had a discussion about how you'd pray for this. And some people said, you know, I think we should just pray that these places are bathed in light. That when we thought about it, we thought that's exactly what would happen in the event of a nuclear war. The first thing that would happen is these are targets. And a nuclear bomb would indeed bathe them in light. We then thought a better image, if we're going to have an image, would be to think of a picture of sort of children playing in fields where the grass is growing up over disused airstrips and a few bits of rusty barbed wire still left on posts and stuff. And that's actually what's happened to many of these nuclear bases. It has actually happened. There was a debate then I was part of about, you know, how would one do this? I just don't know who's thinking about ways of praying in a modern, relevant way. For example, about the ecological crisis. Do we pray for carbon dioxide levels in visualised graphs of falling CO2 levels? Do we think in terms of new evolution to deal with what's happening? Do we think of more species flourishing? The trouble is, almost anything one can think of that does good for the planet would involve there being fewer people or people living more simply.
Well, I wonder whether this is partly asking my question, because I have been reading a little bit about what's sometimes called the greening of Christianity.
Mm.
And essentially it's the idea of Christianity engaging more with the environment. It is a kind of magic, and I actually partly know that because some of the religious communities in the Roman Catholic Church that have been engaging with this have been investigated by the Vatican, that fears that what they're practicing is a sort of pagan magic. So, for example, there's a number of women's communities in the US that have been very much developing an ecological approach to their religious life and shaping their rule of life to correspond with that. And they've been investigated by the Vatican as a result. But now I think about it, I think what they're doing is trying to get a more sophisticated kind of prayer life around it, where they are trying themselves to develop a sense of the pulse of nature, the rhythms of nature, relate, you know, to plants, relate to the local environment in which they live, understand the forces which may be associated with the local rivers, the local wells, that much more powerful participation with their immediate environment. And that feels very different, I think, from, you know, someone going to church on a Sunday praying for the planet before they pop off to Waitrose and buy their Sunday lunch in lots of plastic wrapping, you know, to be a bit crude. But nonetheless, it's asking you to change in your prayer as much as God to sort of just somehow fix it. Maybe that's the difference that I'm sort of driving at here.
I see. Well, that would fit rather well with what you were talking about at the very beginning about this a move towards a different worldview of the earth as alive and so on. I mean, it's thrilling to know that people are doing that. Of course, it ties in with some of the things we've discussed before, like pilgrimage, because pilgrimage is a way of relating to holy places by walking to them and relating to the earth as part of a spiritual practice.
Yeah, that would be another strong example. Now you say that, I'm sure that's right, because that again is about it's a kind of physical prayer where you expect, you put yourself into the play, as it were, to see how things are going to change, what perception of things changes. Yes, yes. So I think that would be another good example. So this brings us just, you know, into perhaps the other question of about animism and about animism and the transcendent. Do you think that there are things which, you know, we can learn from animistic traditions, maybe indigenous cultures, that could be brought into what things which we would be traditionally called magic, that might be brought more into things which would traditionally be called more like prayer, for example?
Well, I think so. I mean, the shamanic traditions have a lot of ceremonies for healing, which are very close to prayer. They have ceremonies about relating to the natural world in various ways. They're traditionally, of course, they're not primary about what we are concerned with now, the future of the planet. They're concerned with finding animals to hunt or plants to eat. I mean, they're much more maintenance type things. As you were saying earlier, a lot of the earlier forms of prayer are about survival, and in the modern world where there's food in supermarkets, which often we take for granted, those are not our immediate concerns. So I think there's a lot to learn, and I think also that as we try and re-understand how God is in nature and nature's in God, or what panentheism, the idea of understanding of nature which is filled with spirit, not just an autonomous machine with spirit, God, angels and so on as an optional extra, but a completely new way of understanding nature. This would give a new way of praying and a new way of relating to it, and it might in part be called magic in the old sense of the word, but again we come back to how we form a new relationship of a new way of praying, which involves the sense of making a difference through the prayer, but not just a difference for our own individual good.
Yeah, and that feels like it could fit with Christian ideas of eschatology, the idea that creation is headed in a certain direction, because when I read about eschatology, the ideas that make the sense to me most are about the creation being lifted to a more developed spiritual sort of sense of awareness and participation. Sometimes it's called the spiritualization of matter.
Yes.
But that sort of sense of animism not being a regression back to an old view of the world, but a progression, which we're very much asked to be actively involved in through our own awareness, bringing that to the natural world. That sort of makes sense to me, I think.
Makes sense to me, and it's obviously one of the great challenges for the future, and maybe we should talk about it in a subsequent dialogue.
Yeah, well thanks very much. I didn't quite know where that was going to go. I thought magic's in the air, but we've perhaps pulled two or three different threads together to pick up at another time.
Well, thank you.
Cheers.